Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Irving checking the three-point line, and he hits! Oh, they double-teamed, and it leads to this! Irving off the backboard again! Irving inside, off the pass on the bounce. Love is fouled in the act! Refers it, J.R. Smith hits the three-point. Clear it out, Irving shoots for three. Here's Shumpert on the drive, and he stops!
Toronto just can't hit shots. Right now, DeRozan and Lowry, 4-for-6 combined, as Darren Williams knocks down the
corner with a deep three attack. Yes! Love with lots of room. Love backs his way. Terrific. Irving shooting over Valanciunas. Irving reverses block. Puts to Carver. He hits the three.
Well, that was the mystery coming into the game of how we would come out. Obviously, you prepare, you want to come out and play well, but you never know after an 8-day layoff. The energy was phenomenal. You know, we pushed the tempo, we shared the ball. We got to where we wanted to get on the floor, both offensively and defensively. We executed. And, I mean, a 30-point quarter after an 8-day layoff is a really good quarter, and we held them to 18 as well. You know, it was a great start for us. Because of being on the road so much, we didn't get a lot of time to actually put in what we wanted to do to get better as a team. So, you know, this week, we had 5 days of practice. You know, we did everything from worked our habits defensively, worked our habits offensively, got some more continuity things put together. We got some great conditioning as a team. You know, like I said, we did a lot this week, you know, because we had the practice time and we're home. So it definitely helped us out a lot.
We just don't want to come out and slow down our pace. If we slow down our pace, allow them to set up their defense every single time down, then it becomes tougher, especially in the fourth quarter where almost we're up 18. They're trying to play desperation basketball. They have Kyle in as well as Corey Joseph, that 1-2 punch, and then we just got to withstand their run, make it fourth quarter ours, which we finished with.
It was very good to see, you know, especially after the layoff. I thought guys came out with a mindset of pushing the basketball and a great defensive mindset. We did that early in the game and we got a big lead, and I was able to, you know, pretty much sustain it in the second half. It was just good to get off to a good start, especially when you haven't played in a while.
Dominate's a tough word. I mean, you use the word dominate. I don't know if you're a fan or what it is. That's a tough word. Again, we didn't play to our game. They made shots. We didn't. We made some mistakes, but I wouldn't use the word dominate. Someone said disrespect. Again, we did enough things positive, and I think we correct those things and bounce back. Again, all you got to do is win one game on the road.
We got to put defense in the game 48 minutes. Some reason when they play home, once they see that ball going, it gets real contagious for them. Everybody knocking down shots for them. You know, we got to buckle down and understand. You know, we got to leave it all out there, especially on the defensive end, and, you know, let that carry us over offensively.
Drilled to center field. Ball hit well. Jackson is on the run. It's over his head up against the wall. Collins to third. They send him home, and he will score. Double and an RBI for Nick Castellanos. Swing and a drive in the air to right field. That ball is hit well, way back, and that ball is gone. It's a three-run shot for Tyler Collins.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Alrighty then, what's going on? Hope you're having an outstanding afternoon as we welcome you to the Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, where we are and will remain Toledo's sports leader. Got about an hour and 48 minutes of outstanding awesome left for you. We're going to talk a lot about the NBA and the NBA playoffs, but we're also going to talk a little bit more about the NFL draft, kind of getting final grades on it. We wanted to talk to somebody yesterday from Cleveland to talk about their draft. We talked, actually Jim Cushland did, with some folks on Friday about the Lions draft. I was off on Friday. Yesterday we had a phone problem, so we couldn't talk to our guests. So we're going to catch up on that a little bit today. And how about the ongoing series between the Indians and the Tigers? What a difference a year makes, Cushland and Gargano. What a difference a year makes. The Indians dominated the Detroit Tigers last year. It's primarily the reason they won the division going away. The Tigers played really, really well against the rest of the division, but got smacked around by the Indians. At one point, I think it was 11 in a row.
Yep.
that they lost on the way to, what, 4-14, I think, against the Indians last year.
That's right.
Kind of different. They took 2 out of 3 from the Indians about a week ago, and now they've already won their first game of this four-game set in Comerica.
Yeah, a solid outing by Norris in this one. Trevor Bauer just didn't have it. The back bats awoke as well for the Tigers. They've now, as you mentioned, taken 3 of the 4 games total play. There's obviously a ton left, but more bad news for the Indians. Miguel Cabrera slated to come off the 10-day DL today, he'll be back in the lineup. Yeah, for us Indians fans, Bob, super!
The Indian killer. Of course. He's coming back now. Couldn't have him come back in the next series. No, he's got to come back against the Indians.
Of course.
Right. Is it going to be baseball, by the way? I mean, rain-wise, what's the story up there?
It's more...
Because it's been all, you know, kind of messing around in high winds and all this other garbage today. I just didn't know what it was like up north of the...
Well, I do know that it's not so much the rain as it is the chilly and the windy. Bundle up if you're headed up to Comerica
They'll play baseball in chilly and windy. I just didn't know if any more rain was going to be messing around.
Yeah, not really as much. But, yeah, the chilly and the rain will be there. It might be 40-something by the time the game starts. So, yeah, needless to say, bundle up either way if you're heading to Comerica Park tonight.
Good luck sitting out there, especially with that wind smacking you in the face.
What's your over under on attendance tonight for a division rivalry game between the defending American League champion Indians at Detroit? Division rivalry, geographical rivalry to some extent as well. But with all the conditions you guys just described, what's your over-under on crowd size?
Basing on what I saw a little bit from the crowd shots last night, I'm going to go over-under of about 17,000.
What do you think, Frank? I'll take the under, by the way.
I was going to say, I'll take the under on that. Saw the crowd yesterday, and it didn't look too great, and I think it's going to be a little bit worse today.
That's what I'm saying, too. I'm coming in at around the double-digit mark. I'm going to go at like 10. I'm going to say 10, 11, 12,000 tops, and I might take the under from that, too, if I threw that number there. But I'm definitely going under 17 if that's the number you're giving me. So, chili at the ballpark tonight. Chili is an understatement to describe the reception that Baltimore Orioles center fielder Adam Jones got from some absolutely reprehensible people at Fenway Park last night. And that's where we're going to start the program today. Yes, we know that there was NBA playoff basketball last night. The Cavaliers, the defending champions, continuing their run undefeated through the postseason thus far. Arguably their most impressive game. In fact, just to throw that out there, I don't even know if it's arguable. Probably more impressive against the Raptors last night than they were in any of the four games against the Pacers. Yes?
No question. Yeah. Just solely on the grounds, they didn't let the lead go away late.
Right. They did let it go away, but not late. Because they were up 18, and then they let a 15-point run go by, something like 15 or, well, whatever it was, they got the lead cut down to 5, or 13-point run. Got the lead, went from 18 down to 5 in the second quarter. And then they pushed it back out, and as you pointed out, they didn't let it disappear after that. So it was a game for a little bit longer than it should have been, really, and then, of course, they did run away with it. So we'll get into all of that. Maniloff's going to join us at 3:35. Coming up at 4:05, more NBA playoffs with Eddie Meissonette, who is just an outstanding guest the first time we talked to him a couple of weeks ago for SB Nation, for Slam Magazine, for Fox Sports and others. So we're going to talk to him about the NBA. So for now, I want to start with this very disturbing story out of Boston yesterday. Howard Bryant, who is an African-American reporter for ESPN, as you know, was on with Russillo and Kane today. It's going to be weird getting used to all of these, you know, show changes and whatnot with all of the ESPN bloodletting that happened last week. No longer Russillo and Cannell. So anyway, it was Will Kane on with Ryan Russillo, and they were talking to Howard Bryant. Howard Bryant grew up in Boston. Black man, grew up in Boston as a kid. And he talked about how, as a kid, he and some of his friends who were also of color kind of learned early on, don't go around Fenway unless you want to get beat up. Boston, not exactly known as the most tolerant of towns in its previous years, maybe its previous iterations. Many people feel like that is a kind of a history, that is history that is they have to own and they have to wear, but it's not the present. It is indeed the past. It's not the present. And which is what makes last night that much tougher to take for, I think, the other people in Boston. They are now being painted as being a racist town overall, a town that doesn't welcome black players, etc. Howard Bryant was on with, again, Russillo and Kane this afternoon, and I heard him say that the which I didn't realize even, or I'd forgotten, I guess, the first black free agent that the Red Sox ever signed, you want to know what year it was?
61.
Well, free agency wasn't even around.
Actually, yeah, you're right. I'm sorry. Free agency. Yeah, I know they were the last team in the American League to integrate, and that was like 58, 59 or something.
Right. But actually signing a black free agent and giving him a contract who's on the open market and outbidding somebody else for him. First time they did that was 1992.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah. That's about 20 years past the start of free agency, if my memory serves. Didn't free agency begin around 73, somewhere in the neighborhood?
Yeah, mid-70s.
They didn't sign a black free agent until 1992. And they didn't really sign a ton of them, really, in those first few years after that either. And as Howard was saying, he said, you know, if you listen to some of the stories told by visiting black players at Fenway, they all heard some stuff. He said guys like Dave Winfield, guys like Don Baylor, guys like Ricky Henderson would go there and hear some pretty outlandish stuff. And it was a real stain on the city of Boston and the Boston fan base. Now, I think most of us, generally speaking, we kind of always say we hate the Patriots, you know, and a lot of us hate the Red Sox and maybe even the Celtics and the Bruins. I don't know about the Bruins as much, but we just kind of, and a lot of the time we say we hate them because of the fans. But it's because of the obnoxiousness of the fans. Not the racial component of the fans
right.
in any way, but they have that history that is not necessarily the present. And when it reared its ugly head in the present, according to Adam Jones, and it was really only involving a few of these either drunken idiots who didn't know what they were doing or racist idiots who knew exactly what they were doing, or maybe a combination of both. A couple of drunks who say racist things when they get drunk. Who knows? But now that it has reared its ugly head here in the present, it is a pretty great concern, and baseball is taking it as such. First, the story, and there are many various iterations of the story. This just happens to be from the New York Post. Orioles center fielder Adam Jones was targeted by a torrent of racist abuse at the hands of Red Sox fans at Fenway Monday night. Fans shouting racial slurs, including the N-word. And one threw a bag of peanuts at the Orioles' five-time All-Star outfielder, according to USA Today's Bob Nightingale. All right, so here, it's one newspaper quoting another newspaper, whatever. Red Sox officials later confirmed that a fan did throw a bag of peanuts into the dugout, and that fan was ejected. Very unfortunate, Jones said. I heard there were 59 to 60 ejections tonight in the ballpark. I just go out and play baseball. It's unfortunate that people need to resort to those types of epithets to degrade another human being. I'm trying to make a living for myself and for my family. It's actually pathetic, Jones said. It's called a coward. What they need to do, instead of kicking them out of the stadium, they need to fine them. $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, something that really, really hurts somebody. Some of the comments from Adam Jones. Now I want to move on here and give you some more context to the story. Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred responding. No, I'm sorry. I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. I don't want to go to baseball yet. Let me go to the Red Sox first. The Red Sox organization itself. The Red Sox did indeed confirm Adam Jones' version of the events, that he was subjected to racial slurs, including the N-word, a, quote, handful of times. And the Red Sox responded before Rob Manfred and baseball even could. This morning, the Red Sox issued the following statement. The Red Sox want to publicly apologize to Adam Jones and the entire Orioles organization for what occurred at Fenway Park Monday night. No player should have an object thrown at him on the playing field, nor be subjected to any kind of racism at Fenway Park. The Red Sox have zero tolerance for such inexcusable behavior, and our entire organization and our fans are sickened by the conduct of an ignorant few. Such conduct should be reported immediately to Red Sox security, and any spectator behaving in this manner forfeits his or her right to remain in the ballpark and may be subject to further action. Our review of last night's events is ongoing. Now, you know as well as I do, because I tell you this all the time, unless it's a really extreme situation, I do not try to mix politics and sports. However, here's a politician, the mayor of the city of Boston. The mayor felt the need to speak out here because he is, you know, I don't want to say on behalf of his city as if it's defensive, but he felt the need to speak out here because of the actions of a few drunken idiots. And I find this to be really, really strange, the way it's, you know, going up the chain, if you will. Mayor Martin Walsh said, quote, "This is unacceptable and not who we are as a city. These words and actions have no place in Fenway, Boston, or anywhere. We are better than this." Didn't stop at the mayor's office. Let's take it further up the chain of the command. The governor of Massachusetts felt the need. Via Twitter, Governor Charlie Baker, quote, "Fenway fans' behavior at the Red Sox game last night was unacceptable and shameful. This is not what Massachusetts and Boston are about." Michelle Wu, president of Boston City Council, said, "Such an incident is demeaning to the city as a whole. No one should be subjected to racial slurs anywhere in our city. It's an insult to all of Boston and to all Red Sox fans that these words were used in the name of our home team." Boston Police Lieutenant Detective Michael McCarthy said the department was unaware of Jones' allegations until officials heard about it from the media earlier this morning. McCarthy said in a statement, "There is an allegation made by a player after the game. There was never an incident reported to the police department or to Fenway. There were no notifications to officers at the park last night by any of the fan spectators or by any other players," end quote. McCarthy did say there were 34 fan ejections from Fenway on Monday night, all handled by Red Sox security and not police, because, again, police were not notified of any other incidents. Jones said he has heard racially abusive comments at Fenway and other parks before, but not to the extent that he did Monday. He said, "Tonight was one of the worst. It's a very different and very unfortunate situation. It is what it is, right? I just go out and play baseball." Now, we go from all of those highly ranking officials, from police to city council to mayors to governors, and now to the commissioner of Major League Baseball, Rob Manfred. Quote, "The racist words and actions directed at Adam Jones at Fenway Park last night are completely unacceptable and will not be tolerated at any of our ballparks. Any individual who behaves in such offensive fashion will be immediately removed from the ballpark and subject to further actions." Now, by the way, Commissioner Manfred wasn't just talking about Fenway. He said at any of the 30 major league ballparks. Anybody using that type of language or throwing something will be ejected. Now, I'm gonna go into a different direction here with this, because I don't think anybody who is a reasonable person would disagree with any of the words that I just read to you. Comments from mayors and governors and club presidents and owners and Major League Baseball commissioners, and certainly player Adam Jones himself. I don't think anybody would disagree with a single word of it, right? The question is this something that is a major problem in sports or in baseball to the degree that it was responded to yesterday? Is this something that is occurring on a frequent basis? So much so that this needs to be addressed in the way that it was? Or was this just the opposite? Was this more of an outlier? And if it was an outlier, did it really deserve all of the attention that it got? And here's what I mean. We all know that there's long been an argument in sports about what a fan is allowed to do and what a fan is allowed to get away with, right? The whole, "I bought my ticket, I can say what I want." Free speech means even the freedom to say something stupid and ignorant and hateful. All of that stuff is part of the discussion. While I certainly agree with the free speech part of that, it is a free country. We have the right to say stupid things. But on the other hand, other people have a right to say, "You have violated a rule. This is private property. This is private property. This is our ballpark, and we have rules here. Rules are you don't use that kind of language. If you do, you're out of here." And that's how it ought to be. But if this is an outlier, do we really do the situation any favors by focusing on it to the degree and the level and rising up the chain the way that it did? And the reason I ask that is, if that is the case, how much more sensitive of rabbit ears are people going to have now in future circumstances where fans are heckling players? At what point, and understand my meaning with this. This is why I kind of brought up the, hey, I don't like to bring politics to sports shows, but understand my meaning here. You know, and I know, that in the course of this country's, evolution from pre-civil rights days to the modern day, to the current day, from Jim Crow laws to where we are, where essentially, I believe we have built ourselves to, a pretty doggone, equal for all society. Language has still been an issue. And what everybody agrees is the most egregious of slurs, which is the N-word, which Adam Jones was subjected to. Nobody would argue that that is an unacceptable word. It certainly is unacceptable by any standards. In the decades since those other years, people have gone on to say, well, this is a new version of the N-word, or that is a new version of the N-word, or there is the gay version of the N-word, or there is the female version of the N-word. If you understand, you know what I mean? There are slurs, and then there are slurs. And some people are saying, this one has gotten so bad, it's just as bad as the N-word. And we find ourselves in society then saying, oh my, if that's going to be viewed as the same as the N-word, well, then we can't say that either. And suddenly we've got a list of 5, 10, 15, 20, Lord knows how many words are going to be grounds for dismissal from the ballpark. How are they going to police speech? Or are they going to say it very specifically? If you say this word in talking to a player or yelling at a player, you're out of here. Is there going to be a list, a sign, on the railings in all of the different seating sections at the ballparks, saying here are codes of conduct, these are the words that are allowed, these are the words that are not allowed? I'm wondering how they're going to deal with this on a large-scale basis. To the Adam Jones comment, and I'll leave this here for now, to the Adam Jones comment in which he said that, and I, by the way, I like Adam Jones, and I really, for the most part, like the way he handled this too. I really do. A hell of a player. And he seems like a very good guy too. The way he described it, he said, you know what, I hear this stuff all the time, and it's just, I'm just going to do my job. And he doesn't usually let it bother him. But this one particularly bothered him more because, A, somebody threw something at him. Doesn't matter what it was. Harmless as a bag of peanuts or dangerous as a battery. You throw something, you got a problem. But he said this time the language was so bad and was so repetitive, and so it was one of the worst he's seen. He had a right to speak out about this. So I support Adam Jones in any and every way you can support somebody in a situation like this, except for one small mistake that I think Adam Jones made. When he said, quote, what they need to do is, instead of kicking them out of the stadium, they need to fine them $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, something that really hurts somebody, make them pay in full, and if they don't, take it out of their check. When you say something like that, you know what you've just done? You've really demonstrated that you are out of touch with the average, ordinary fan. Only baseball players can get fined 10 or 20 or 30 grand and take it out of their checks, or take away a game check for a suspendable offense, because baseball players make 300 grand a game, just to throw a number out there. So you get a 10, 20 grand, 30 grand. You're not going to do that to an idiot, drunken mailman or factory worker or, radio host or whatever, whoever's out there doing something. You're going to hold them accountable. You're going to hold them accountable by ejecting them, maybe even making them ineligible to return. You have a suspension for the season. You don't get to come back to Fenway. We won't sell you a ticket. You can do things like that, but to suggest a $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000 fine to somebody who's just a regular ham and egger, somebody who's not out there making Major League Baseball player money, that shows you're a little bit out of touch. So, Adam, great job of handling it, I think. It sounds like he's dealt with this before, and he's kind of above the fray, and that's a really, really good thing. Rob Manfred, way to lay down the law. That's fine. Do we need to go much higher than that? I don't know. But let's stay in touch here. Let's remember, you're playing a game in which what you make is a little bit different than what a fan makes. And even if you're trying to punish a fan, you don't punish a fan with player-type fines. Now we're getting into a little bit of the loony zone. All right, we're going to take a quick time out here. We're going to come back. We're going to talk to our friend Dennis Maniloff. We're going to talk a little bit about the NBA last night. The Cavaliers win over the Toronto Raptors to start the Eastern Conference semifinals. How about the Spurs going down and going down hard at the hands of James Harden and the Houston Rockets? We'll get into that a little bit. A little bit of a draft recap as well. And much, much more coming up after I remind you about the only all-inclusive private country club in Northwest Ohio, and it is Brandywine in Maumee. I'm going out there tomorrow with my friend Billy Michaels. We're going to go out there and swing the sticks tomorrow afternoon and maybe try to get nine in because we're such good friends with Dale and the folks at Brandywine. You need to check this club out. Seriously. You know, people take all-inclusive vacations. You pay one low price, and then they covers your airfare, covers your hotel, covers your meals, covers your events, and so on and so forth. That's how it is at Brandywine. It's a constant all-inclusive vacation. Golf, golf cart, pool, fitness, social clubs, it's all covered under one low price at the new Brandywine Country Club. And the club, by the way, is phenomenal for a lot of reasons, but, you know, the golf course is just amazing. It's Arthur Hill's championship golf. It's a design, 18 holes. The layout is simply spectacular. Three par fives on the front nine. If you love golf, you're going to have a great time at Brandywine. And if you love food, whether you're a member of Brandywine or not, the Champions Bar and Grill that reopened last year in the summer is now open to the public. And the menu is simply spectacular. You got to check it out for yourself. Call this phone number, 419-865-2393. There are great membership specials going on right now. The Young Executive Golf and Club membership is on sale. The Early Bird Golf and Club membership is on sale. The Fitness membership as well. The Full Golf and membership as well. And by the way, if you join the club by May 31st, they will waive your initiation fee. That's right. Call 419-865-2393 and join us at the all-new, all-inclusive Brandywine Country Club in Maumee. Maniloff joins us next right here on The Ticket.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Obviously, you prepare, you want to come out and play well, but you never know. After the eight-day layoff, the energy was phenomenal. You know, we pushed the tempo, we shared the ball, we got to where we wanted to get on the floor, both offensively and defensively. We executed, and I mean, a 30-point quarter after an 8-day layoff is a really good quarter, and we held them to 18 as well. You know, it was a great start for us.
It was indeed a great start for the Cavaliers last night in Game 1 of their Eastern Conference semifinal series, a rematch, if you will, of the same series a year ago against the Toronto Raptors. Cavaliers took it to the Raptors and really looked like they had no rust whatsoever. But most importantly, they looked for the first time this playoff season, like the complete defending championship team that they're supposed to be. I didn't think I really saw much of that at all during the Indiana Pacers series. Certainly the most complete performance they've had in the playoffs thus far. Join us now to break it down and much, much more is our friend Dennis Maniloff, who joins us from Cleveland. Hey, D-Man, how are you?
What's up, Bob France? How you doing, bud?
So sorry about yesterday, brother. We tried to get you on the line so we can talk about the draft, you know, just in the immediate aftermath of it, and then also the previewing, you know, last night's game is what we planned to yesterday, but we had obviously a problem. Thanks for making yourself available today.
No problem. We're here now. Let's go.
All right, let's start right there. I really, even though it was a sweep in the first round against the Pacers, they were very close games for the most part. They had to survive a couple of daggers at the end in two of those games in which Indiana really could have made this thing interesting, and still kind of got the feeling they couldn't hold leads very well late in games. Boy, they put it all together, I thought, for the first time really in the entire postseason, and maybe with the exception of that one dominating performance at Boston late in the season, for the first time in the last couple of months. What did you see?
I agree with you to a large extent. It was a very good performance by the Cavaliers. They should feel good about it. But by no means do I think this series is over. In fact, I think this series is going seven games, and I get laughed at for saying that. Yeah, and this is the reason. Because the Cavaliers, they're not going to change their spots overnight. They're not going to change. This 2016-2017 team is not going to change its DNA overnight. It's not going to suddenly become a consistent, dominant team, like maybe the one that everybody's expecting. I still anticipate this is going to be a team that's going to be up and down, not only in games but in series. And it wouldn't surprise me if Toronto came back and beat them in Game 2. One of the reasons, if I were Toronto, I'd be
so angry at the Cavaliers that it's not even funny. I mean, I would say you guys are clowning me. You got LeBron with the beer. You got Dante Jones doing his thing. You got flipping off the glass on a dunk. I mean, and I'm not saying that the Cavs don't have the right to do that, and they're feeling good about themselves. But if I'm the opponent, I'm like, all right, they just challenged our manhood here. We got to come out, and we got to get after them. And I think Toronto's capable of doing that.
Do you think that the players feel disrespected by those clownish type things that you talked about? Because
100%.
Dwayne Casey was asked about that in the post game. In fact, I'll play Kenny Rota's question, a mutual friend of ours, that kind of got under Casey's skin a little bit about domination. But he was asked specifically about, do you feel disrespected by them, you know, doing a couple of lobs and playing with the carefree looseness that they were. And Casey basically said, no, I don't feel disrespected at all. We played like garbage, and we got to play better. Do you think the players will mirror that, or do you think they will take it more personally?
I think they'll take it personal. If you don't, Toronto, then where's your intestinal fortitude? Because here's the thing, Bob, I'm not going to be hypocritical. If the other team, if the team that I, you know me, I mean, I want to see the Cavs succeed because I'm from here. I'm not rooting for them openly as a member of the media, but I'd like to see the Cavs succeed more so, of course, than the Raptors. But if the team I'm watching is on the other end of this, I'm going to accuse the opponent of clowning. And I'm going to say, they're clowning you. And what are you going to do about it? So I'm not going to be hypocritical just because the Cavs are doing it and say it's fine. And again, the Cavs can do whatever they want in a game. It's just the question of, are they going to get the attention of the other team to the point where their focus is sharpened and they play much better? And, I don't know. To me, I just don't poke the bear like that. I just play the game hard, and if you trounce them, you trounce them, but you do it with, complete class. I don't want to say, though, that the Cavs are classless, because that's not, these instances were not classless moves. They were just indicative of a team that was feeling so good about itself that it almost seemed like they were, poking a finger in the eye of the opposition. And I think Toronto's too talented to do that against.
Okay, two things in response to that. And then Cushion's got a question for you, too, Dennis. You kind of got at one of them there with your last comment. I was going to say maybe the Cavaliers don't fear any wrath from the Raptors. You think it's going seven, and maybe they're like, these guys can get as mad as they want. They can't hang with us. So that's the second part, is do you think they can hang? And apparently you do. The first part is, can you give the Cavaliers a pass at all? I'm not saying you have to, but I mean, is there any room for consideration that they've sat for 8 days watching everybody else play? They're bored out of their gourd. They want to get on with this thing, get back into the playoffs. They get on the court. They find out there's no rust. They're on their game, and they're feeling giddy, and they're just happy, and they're having fun. And it did get a little bit kind of, fun, and here comes Kyrie on the break. I'm going to lay it up there and let LeBron hammer it home. And, it's not really this is to disrespect you, Toronto, but this is just the fun that we haven't had for the last 8 days that we've been waiting to play. Any room for just kind of a youthful, not youthful, over exuberance because of the long delay?
Absolutely, Bob. Yes, there's plenty of room for that. I mean, all I'm trying to convey is, and again, I don't have a problem. I just want to be very clear. I don't have a problem with what the Cavaliers did for what you just said. They were enjoying themselves. They had a long layoff. They finally got to play. They realized they were clicking. They realized they were in control of the game. And they were having fun. Nothing wrong with any of that. Oh, by the way, they're at home. Okay. So they're entitled to do all that. All I was saying was, if I were the Raptors, I would be furious with that kind of stuff, and it would motivate me. Now, you made a great point, though, in the first of the two, that you made, and that is, even if the Raptors are riled up, are they good enough to beat the Cavaliers, specifically in Cleveland? That's the issue. Because you remember last year, the Raptors, admittedly with a few different pieces, but with the basic core, was able to handle the Cavaliers twice in Toronto. So in a series that won six games. So it's, the problem has been for Toronto in Cleveland. They haven't been able to figure them out, and that's the Rota-based question, I believe. So, you know, maybe the Cavs say, even if you are upset, oh, well, because we know we can beat you in Cleveland.
Dennis Manilov is our guest. We're talking about the NBA playoffs, particularly the Cavaliers' first-round win over the Raptors yesterday in the Eastern Conference semis. Jim Kushlin is with us as always. Jimmy, go ahead.
Wait, Bob. I'm sorry to interrupt. By the way, a nice masterstroke performance there by the great Greg Popovich and his San Antonio Spurs. I guess it's all part of the master plan to get boat raced in your own building by Houston. Nice work there, Pop.
I was going to ask you about the Thunder win over San Antonio. Don't worry, we'll get there. We're going to stay here now, though, on the Cavaliers first. Then we'll get to that one. Don't believe me. And I got some Popovich audio for you, too. So I know you're going to have some fun with. Jimmy, go ahead.
You know, back to this Cavs Raptors thing, because it was one of the last things you said there, Dennis. We were talking about the Cavs playing this team at home, and whether you're talking last year's playoffs, the couple games this season, or yesterday, the Cavs have more or less owned this team in Cleveland, and that's about the only disagreement with it. For me, I still see this series going six, and in terms of win-loss-wise, I think it's going to play out a lot like last year. The Cavs will go up 2-0. They'll run into some roadblocks when the atmosphere changes, you know, in Toronto. How likely are we to see something like that again, where maybe the Cavs after tomorrow are up 2-0, but then we got a 2-2 series? How possible do you think something like that is?
Very possible, Kush, and I think it's going to be 1-1, to be honest. And I have people, again, laugh at me. How could you say that? You know, the Cavaliers at home, you just got done saying they don't lose to the Raptors in Cleveland. I respect the Raptors to the extent that I think they can figure it out here in Cleveland tomorrow night, especially against a Cavaliers team that, as I said, I don't think has suddenly morphed into a consistent dominant force. I still think we're going to have these crazy bumps in the road, this crazy sort of roller coaster characteristics with these guys, where they're going to get into trouble in games and things will bog down. And I don't know, I guess I just respect Toronto's talent too much, the additions of guys like Ibaka, that I think they can pull out the second game, and that'll create a heck of a series. I'll say this, Toronto's going to come out, they have to come out absolutely blazing in the first quarter of game two, thinking, you know what, we got to set a tone here, we got to get a lead, and we'll see. But I do believe this, even with the game one result and how it played out, I do believe that Toronto can make this a heck of a series.
If you're wrong about game two and the Cavaliers win, especially if they win it comfortably, and that doesn't have to be in as great a fashion as yesterday, but comfortably, do you retract that going seven prediction of yours?
No, Bob, because, again, I'm not convinced that the Cavs have turned the corner, that they have flipped the switch to consistency. What I have said about the Cavs, though, after the first series against Indiana, I said this, and I'm going to stick with it the rest of the postseason. I'm not counting the Cavaliers out until they have four L's next to their name in one series. That's how I'm going to view the Cavs. In other words, when I see them look bad during a game, or, you know, in pockets of a game, or they lose a game, or they maybe get routed on the road, or something like that, I'm not going to sit here and go, oh, the series is over, they have no chance. The only time I will say the Cavaliers have no chance is when they have four L's next to their name in the same series. Otherwise, I'm just going to watch the inconsistency unfold in front of my eyes and see what happens.
Fair enough, Dennis. All right, so Dennis, I'm going to play this for you now. This is a mutual friend of ours, Kenny Rota, who does radio down in Canton now, asking Dwayne Casey this question that apparently got Casey a little bit riled up. I don't think he went off the chain at all, but obviously he did not like the tone of the question or the word that was used here. So let's give this a listen.
Dwayne, Kenny Rota, WHBC. In order to win this series, you have to win one game on the road. Playing here the last 2 years in the playoffs,
they've dominated you double digits every time, and DeMar and Kyle seem to struggle on the road. What has to change with those two as well as the team in order to get a road win and have a chance to win this series?
Well, just would you say Cleveland struggle in Toronto?
Well, the first game, yes.
Yeah. Two games. I think
the other one was
games.
A six-point game, then they won the last game.
Well, dominate's a tough word. I mean, you use the word dominate. I mean, I don't know if you're a fan or what it is, but that's a tough word. Again, we didn't play to our game. They made shots. We didn't. We made some mistakes, but I wouldn't use the word dominate, you know, with that term. So, again, if someone said disrespect. Again, we did enough things positive, and I think we correct those things and bounce back. Again, all you got to do is win one game on the road.
If you're beating a team by double digits every single time you play them in your building, if you're beating somebody that badly, you are indeed dominating them. So what was your take on Casey getting a little bit, I don't know if testy is the right word, but clearly he challenged whether or not this was a reporter or a guy being a fan there and pretending to be a reporter.
Yeah, didn't blame anybody for anything up until, you know, Casey demeaning the great Kenny Rota by saying, I don't know if you're a fan. That's uncalled for. That's below the belt. That's unnecessary. Roadman is, as we know, great guy, great reporter, does good things, always asks the tough questions in those big pressers, never afraid to pull the trigger on it. I thought his question was completely fair. I don't have a problem with him using the word dominated because, it has been a lopsided situation for the Raptors on balance when they come to Cleveland in the past couple of years.
I've never known that word to be considered disrespectful. I mean, to me, it's an adjective, you know, or a verb.
Right.
If you dominate somebody or your victory was dominant. I mean, I think we all know what domination looks like, right?
Right. And so I didn't have any problem with Roadman doing what he did or the choice of his words or the question or whatever it is. Everything was right on the Roadman's part. At the same time, I didn't have a problem with anything Casey said because he doesn't want to sort of sign off on it and say, oh, yeah, they dominated. I mean, I don't blame him for being defensive about it because he wants to project to his team, convey to his team, hey, we're all right. I mean, just because we've got a little past here that's not good and just because they handled us tonight doesn't mean the series is over. Doesn't mean we're not going to win tomorrow night or Wednesday night. So I don't blame Casey for being defensive about it. I thought he, there were no expletives or anything. So it was a fair exchange. But again, the only part that I disagree with is when Casey goes to the fan card. That's weak. I leave that out of it. Obviously, Roadman's a credentialed member of the media.
Right.
He just said that in the microphone. So that was the only part that I disagreed with.
Fair enough. I want to get to the Spurs and Rockets game one. How about your boys from Houston putting one on your favorite coach of all time, Greg Popovich, and the Spurs as James Harden, Trevor Ariza, and others went off?
We lost, and they won, and they played better. I'm going to try to be nice. I'm going to really try. Am I going to worry about carryover, like we'll come and play just as badly again, or the guys won't show up? Last time I checked, I was a coach, and there's not much that coaches don't worry about, but that won't be one of them, in all honesty.
Greg, they had a lot of open threes.
I was just kidding about more questions. Jesus. No, go ahead. I got nothing to do. Just make sure the wine's back there.
So a little stand-up comedy for Greg Popovich in the post-game presser after that loss to Houston, and it was a big one, and it was an ugly one, and I want to say, what was it, 27 was the final margin there? I'd say even he would admit that they got dominated. He might not like. He might be okay with that word where Dwayne Casey was not. They got dominated by the Rockets last night. Do you think the Rockets can win that series?
Oh, absolutely. The stars have aligned perfectly for Bob France and I because, on one hand, Bob France's MVP, James Harden, is doing his thing. And on the other hand, the team that's getting run over by Harden is my favorite, the Spurs. Anytime Popovich loses, it's a beautiful thing. His smugness, his arrogance, it's so good to see him get thumped, especially in San Antonio. How many series, Pop, have you won in the last two postseasons? Let's see. You won the first round this year. I think you won one round last year, and you won zero rounds the year before that. So, all this business, oh, he's got all the rings. Okay, great. But what have you done for me lately, Pop? All right? Now, maybe I'm talking smack at him right now. Maybe he comes back and wins this series.
You put the word maybe in front of that?
Well, okay. But, here's the thing. I'm sure that the Pop defenders, oh,
This is part of his master plan. He just wants to lull the Rockets into a false sense of security, and then he's going to spring all his little surprises on them. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if this series goes deep, and it wouldn't surprise me, I guess, if the Spurs win it, all right? I'm not dissing them to that extent. But I am saying I love when the Spurs lose, and especially when they get hammered and just, you know, boat raced, whatever word you want to use, like they were yesterday, and in their house, because of Popovich's arrogance. It has nothing to do with the players.
I got you.
You know, those players on that team seem to be a real decent bunch. It's just Popovich is so smug. You know, he invented the game. He's such a genius. He's always got to spar with reporters, except for that little giggly sound bite. I'd love to see woo, 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 and the beard like the billy goat sweep those guys right out of the playoffs.
Jim Cushland's got another question for you. Jimmy, go ahead.
You know, and I'm glad.
What up, Coach?
And I'm glad, Dennis, that you brought up what happened to the Spurs the last couple years of the playoffs, because honest to goodness, I'm throwing this is for you too, Bob. I'm throwing this question out. What is wrong with the Spurs these last couple years in the playoffs? 2 years ago, they lost to the Clippers in seven in the first round, a Clippers team that, as constituted, can't seem to get it done in the playoffs. Last year, as you mentioned, they won the first round series, but that was a shell Memphis team before losing out to the Thunder. And then this year, when they get the full Memphis team, that goes six. And then last night, they haven't looked like the Spurs in the playoffs since they beat LeBron in 2014, his last year in Miami. So open question, you guys. What's wrong with these Spurs in the playoffs?
Well, I mean, yeah, they'll say it's the rugged Western Conference and it's so difficult to win in the West. But I'm glad Kush pointed that out. I mean, their first round exit a couple years ago was to the horrendously underperforming in the playoffs LA Clippers, all right, of all teams. But my point is about this. Yes, Pop has all the rings. But can you imagine if LeBron in his past two seasons had a first-round exit and a second-round exit, okay? The criticism that would rain down on him for being such a terrible, terrible postseason player, underachieving, what's wrong with LeBron? But somehow, Popovich is bulletproof. Well, yeah, you can't expect him to win every year, and the West is too rugged and all that. But to Kush's point, I think it's a matter of, you know, some of these teams are quicker and they shoot better overall than the Spurs do, specifically Golden State. I think Houston is more athletic. They're a better defensive team with that athleticism than San Antonio is. But again, I get it. San Antonio's not done in this series by any stretch. It's just that I'm not expecting them to certainly get to the finals, and that would be three straight years without a finals appearance for the mighty Spurs.
Yeah, and my answer to that question, by the way, it is the West. That is a big, big part of this thing. The West is a meat grinder, and I'll tell you something, just to take your comparison further. If LeBron had gone to a team in the Western Conference, he wouldn't be going to the finals every year. There would be second-round ousters. There might be a first-round ouster.
Don't be selling the Kings.
I'm telling you, it's different than when you have to go to Indiana and Toronto. And then the last question I have for you now, which, of course, is who is waiting if the Cavaliers survive what you think is going to be a tough seven-gamer here against the Raptors. Is it Boston or is it Washington, and which would you prefer, Dennis Manilov? I only got about 40 seconds. Go ahead.
I think the Celtics are going to do this. They've found their way. I mean, they've gotten through the tragedy involving Isaiah Thomas' sister. They found their footing. They got a break, obviously, with Rondo being out of the series. I think they're going to win the series against Washington. And they will be a tough out, especially because they have home court, no matter who they play, either Toronto or Cleveland.
All right, good stuff, Dennis Manilov. As always, my friend, thanks very much. We'll talk to you again sometime next week, if that's all right, and we'll get another update. We didn't have much time to talk about the draft, but there's plenty of time for that as well. All right, my man?
You better call me after the Spurs get eliminated.
I'll call you no matter what happens in that series. You know that. All right, thanks very much, Dennis. All right, it's 4:01, so I tell you what, on our way into the top of the hour Sports Center, how about I hook you up with those Mud Hens tickets I could not give you yesterday because of our phone problem. Mud Hens in Louisville play on Friday, and I've got a couple of pairs of tickets. I'll give them to callers 5 and 6 right now during the top of the hour, 866-240-1065 is the number. Callers 5 and 6, you'll each get a pair of tickets to the Hens and Louisville on Friday at 5th Third, and we're back.
Love 4-3. Yes.
Jesse Irving checking the three-point line, and he hits. Oh, they double teamed, and it leads to this. Irving off the backboard James. Irving inside. Off the pass on the bounce. Love is fouled in the air. Reverses. J.R. Smith hits the three-point. Clear it out. Irving shoots for three. There's Shumpert on the drive, and he stops.
Toronto just can't hit shots. You know, right now, DeRozan and Lowry, 4-for-6 combined, as Darren Williams knocks down the
corner with a deep three attack. Yes. Love with lots of room. Love backs his way. And terrific. Irving shooting over Valanciunas. Irving reverses block. Puts to Carver. He hits the three.
Well, that was the mystery coming into the game of how we would come out. Obviously, you prepare, you want to come out and play well, but you never know after an eight-day layoff. The energy was phenomenal. You know, we pushed the tempo, we shared the ball. We got to where we wanted to get on the floor, both offensively and defensively. We executed, and, I mean, a 30-point quarter after an eight-day layoff is a really good quarter, and we held them to 18 as well. You know, it was a great start for us. Because of being on the road so much, we didn't get a lot of time to actually put in what we wanted to do to get better as a team. So, you know, this week we have 5 days of practice. You know, we did everything from worked our habits defensively, worked our habits offensively, got some more continuity things put together. We got some great conditioning as a team. You know, like I said, we did a lot this week, you know, because we had the practice time and we're home. So it definitely helped us out a lot.
We just don't want to come out and slow down our pace. If we slow down our pace, allow them to set up their defense every single time down, then it becomes tougher, especially in the fourth quarter where almost we're up 18. They're trying to play desperation basketball. They have Kyle in as well as Corey Joseph, that 1-2 punch, and then we just got to withstand their run, make it fourth quarter ours, which we finished with.
It was very good to see, you know, especially after the layoff. I thought guys came out with a mindset of pushing the basketball and a great defensive mindset. We did that early in the game, and we got a big lead, and I was able to, you know, pretty much sustain it in the second half. It was just good to get out to a good start, especially when you haven't played in a while.
Dominate is a tough word. I mean, you use the word dominate. I don't know if you're a fan or what it is. That's a tough word. Again, we didn't play to our game. They made shots. We didn't. We made some mistakes, but I wouldn't use the word dominate. Someone said disrespect. Again, we did enough things positive, and I think we correct those things and bounce back. Again, all you got to do is win one game on the road.
We got to put defense in the game for 48 minutes. Some reason when they play home, once they see that ball going, it gets real contagious for them. Everybody knocking down shots for them. You know, we got to buckle down and understand. You know, we got to leave it all out there, especially on the defensive end, and, you know, let that carry us over offensively.
Drilled to center field. Ball hit well. Jackson is on the run. It's over his head up against the wall. Collins to third. They send him home, and he will score. Double and an RBI for Nick Castellanos. Swinging a drive in the air to right field. That ball is hit well, way back, and that ball is gone. It's a three-run shot.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yeah, we don't need no stinking baseball highlights. No. Not when we're going to talk to Eddie Meissonette about the NBA playoffs. A lot of really interesting stuff happening last night. The Cavaliers, after an eight-day layoff, they show no rust whatsoever as they hammer the Toronto Raptors. Dwayne Casey not real thrilled with some of the questions he got in the postgamer. How about your Houston Rockets behind my league MVP, which is James Harden, taking it to somebody else's MVP? I'm assuming there's some people in San Antonio feel that way. About Kawhi Leonard, Greg Popovich having a little bit of a comedy festival after the game yesterday. And, of course, we roll onward. We've got the Wizards and Celtics and, of course, the Golden State Warriors. And much to their chagrin, they have to play in boring old Utah when they get to Game 3 and Game 4. Welcome, hour number 2 underway right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. As I alluded to, Eddie Meissonette, full-time contributor at Fox Sports, editor-in-chief of the Sports Fan Journal, also contributes to Slam Magazine and SB Nation, back to talk more NBA playoffs with us right here on ESPN 106.5, Yon Ticket. Eddie, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing well, Bob. I'm just trying to be like Dante Jones, get picked up for one game at the end of the season, live my best life, and try to make another run at a championship, and get ejected every once in a while and have LeBron pay my fines.
I was going to say, yeah, and cost LeBron James more money.
Yeah, man. Hey, if you got the big homie LeBron cashing those checks for you, man, I'm willing to take it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you don't have to watch your temper. You don't have to worry about it. I mean, seriously, I mean, ain't my money I'm spending is LeBron's. I'll do whatever I want to do. Dante's got to get out of jail free card there, if you will, at least out of fines free. All right, Eddie, let's start there. And I don't know why, but I'm really kind of more fixated. Maybe it's because I know the reporter. I'm a little bit fixated on the Dwayne Casey question at the end of the after the game yesterday. I know the reporter. He's a friend of mine. He does radio down in Canton now, home of the Pro Football Hall of Fame, about an hour outside of Cleveland. And he's the one who asked the question. Let's listen again and get your reaction.
Dwayne, Kenny Rowe at WHBC. In order to win this series, you have to win one game on the road. Playing here the last 2 years in the playoffs, they've dominated you double digits every time, and DeMar and Kyle seem to struggle on the road. What has to change with those two as well as the team in order to get a road win and have a chance to win this series?
Well, just would you say Cleveland struggle in Toronto?
Well, the first game, yes.
Yeah. Two games. I think
the other one was
games.
A six-point game, then they won the last game.
Well, dominate's a tough word. I mean, you use the word dominate. I mean, I don't know if you're a fan or what it is, but that's a tough word. Again, we didn't play to our game. They made shots. We didn't. We made some mistakes, but I wouldn't use the word dominate, you know, with that term. So, again, if someone said disrespect. Again, we did enough things positive, and I think we correct those things and bounce back. Again, all you got to do is win one game on the road.
Eddie, I don't know about you, but I would use the word dominate. When you look at the way last night's game played out, and the question that the reporter asked was about the series last year and this year in the regular season, whenever Toronto comes to Cleveland, they lose by double digits just about every time. That is straight-up domination. Your take?
Yeah, I feel like Dwayne Casey is like, hey, dude, my mom and my wife and my kids are watching this press conference, and you ain't going to be talking about me any old type of way in front of them. And so I think he lashed out. And I think as a professional athlete, a professional coach, when you're in that environment, I think that it can at times you find reasons to feel slighted. And it feels like for Dwayne Casey, he probably built this up in a way so that he can take it back to the locker room and say, like, this is how they're talking about you. Of course, Bob, I totally agree with you. This totally felt like a domination in the highest order. And, you know, they got embarrassed. And that's okay. Like, it happens. The beauty of the NBA playoffs is that you only got to get to four. It doesn't matter how much you get beat. And if I'm Dwayne Casey, hopefully that's the type of viewpoint you take going into game two.
One of the other questions, Eddie, that he got in that press conference was about whether or not the Cavaliers were disrespecting them at all, because, you know, they did do a couple of things, you know, LeBron stopping to get a beer and, of course, Kyrie on a break throwing one off the glass that LeBron threw down with his left hand, by the way, like he does it all the time. That was crazy to me. Because I don't care how good you are as a left-handed player, you know, there's so many of these guys, Kyrie is one of them, who's just as good around the basket with his left as he is with his right. LeBron's certainly the same way, but the way he grabbed that with his left hand flying and threw it down as if he was left-handed was just sick. But were the Cavaliers clowning them a little bit too much, in your opinion?
Well, I'm here for the entertainment, so I'm always going to be pro-entertainment. But one of the old adages is what? That respect is earned, not given. And, look, the Toronto Raptors have not proven to the world that they have really earned our respect. It's the reason why, as I said earlier, that the Raptors are always featured on NBA TV when the playoffs come around because, frankly, like, they haven't done enough to deserve our attention. It doesn't mean that they aren't a good basketball team. It doesn't mean that they don't come play hard. And I think the additions of Serge Ibaka and T.J. Tucker are going to make a difference in the series. But this is the Cleveland Cavaliers. This is the same LeBron James that said that regular season games really don't matter to him as far as how long he's been in the league. And the Toronto Raptors, until further notice, haven't done enough to deserve LeBron or the Cleveland Cavaliers respect. Like, I was actually hoping LeBron would take a swig of the beer. I mean, you know, there might be a certain cut of folks that want to see more class and more respect and dignity from the NBA and from the Cavaliers. But if that's what you want, go watch golf or go watch something else. I don't care. I just want to have fun. They're having fun, and they whooped up on Toronto. And Toronto got to go back and put the wood on them in game two.
Eddie Meissonet is our guest. He is an outstanding basketball pundit and columnist.
You are
contributor
too kind.
To Fox Sports, editor-in-chief of the Sports Fan Journal. You do what? Slam Magazine, SB Nation? That's one hell of a big business card you must have. I don't know how you fit all that on there.
Hey, man, I have my own power rankings depending on which one pays me the most. So right now it's Fox most, but that Fox Sports, so that could change at any time.
That is fine by me, my friend. All right, short series, by the way, or do you think this can go 6 or 7?
Oh, I think it goes 6 or 7. It's weird because I think Toronto has, you know, the additions of Tucker and Ibaka were made specifically, I think, to go after the Cleveland Cavaliers. And it's up to Dwayne Casey to unlock those players and to get better shots for DeRozan and Lowry. And he just hasn't figured out how to do it yet. There might be a bigger question of, is he capable of figuring that part out? But that's a different question for a different day. I think it goes six games.
Let's stay in the East. The Celtics really took it to the Washington Wizards in game number one. I think a lot of people, you know, kind of feel like the Wizards are the trendy pick, if you will, to be the team that gives the Cavaliers the most trouble on their way back to yet another NBA Finals. I was among that group. I kind of feel like they are more dangerous, but you got to get by Boston before you can be dangerous to the Cavaliers. Do you think they're going to?
It's really interesting because I think if I had to trust a player, anybody on those two teams, I think I'm still trusting John Wall over anybody else. And John Wall came to play in game one. He balled out. It was just really weird to look up and see, oh, the Wizards are up 16-0, 22-5. And then all of a sudden the Celtics have a 15-point lead on the Wizards. I think this might be the most entertaining series we get in the second round, because I could totally see the Wizards blowing out the Celtics in game two and acting like game one never happened. So, you know, you've got two coaches that are still figuring themselves out on this side of the bracket. I mean, with Stevens, you know, he's been there for a while, but he's the top dog, and that's a lot for him now. And then you've got Scott Brooks, who was an upgrade from their past coach. But they're still trying to figure out still how to get the most out of their roster. And they're still relying on guys like Oubre and Otto Porter and guys like that to give them a big chunk of output. And I sometimes wonder if they're really the answers that they need. So it'll be interesting to see the adjustments they have in game two. I look for Beal to play a lot better, but he's got two dogs. I think Boston doesn't get enough credit for Avery Bradley and Marcus Smart just being defensive bloodhounds. And they really slowed Beal down, so they're going to have to figure out how to get Beal unlocked in game two.
You make some very good points. I don't know why it is, and maybe it's just because of the way the Cavaliers manhandled Boston in that last showdown of the regular season in Boston. I feel like the Wizards would give them a better fight, and so I kind of want that to happen. I want to see a really good Eastern Conference Finals. I feel like the Cavaliers would manhandle Boston a lot more because they just have the one ball dominant score, whereas the Wizards have a couple of scores and Bradley Beal as well as John Wall. So we'll see, but I really hope it is the Wizards. Eddie, let's talk about my MVP, the guy that I, if I had a vote, I would vote for James Harden. I made that clear to you. We've talked about this before. He and they looked tremendous last night in blowing out. In fact, they were so good against the San Antonio Spurs, they got notorious grump Greg Popovich to do stand-up comedy, essentially, last night at the postgamer.
We lost, and they won, and they played better. I'm going to try to be nice. I'm going to really try. Am I going to worry about carryover, like we'll come and play just as badly again, or the guys won't show up? Last time I checked, I was a coach, and there's not much that coaches don't worry about, but that won't be one of them, in all honesty.
Greg, they had a lot of open threes.
I was just kidding about more questions. Jesus. No, go ahead. I got nothing to do. Just make sure the wine's back there.
So Pop is looking for a glass of wine, just wants to forget about this one, but he said he has no worries that his guys will be ready for game number two. There was a time for maybe a blink of an eye during the regular season, Eddie, that I thought maybe the Spurs, you know, when they were pressing up on the Warriors and only a game or two back and they had this incredible run going, where I thought maybe the Spurs are the best team in the West and not the Warriors. That went away quickly, but boy, I still thought they'd handle this series, and I don't know if I think that anymore.
Yeah, I think it's interesting when there was a point towards the end, we were getting close to the nitty-gritty of the end of the season, where the Spurs might be able to surpass the Warriors for best record in the West. And I think some people believe that the Spurs needed to get to the one seed just for this particular reason, because you look at how the Spurs are built. You know, they're built around this dynamic player, Kawhi Leonard, and they've got, a nice cast of front court players like LaMarcus Aldridge and Pau Gasol, David Lee, Dwayne Dedman. And then they've got guys that are still functional at the guard. But the Houston Rockets are a terrible matchup for the Spurs, because those bigs become almost inconsequential when it comes to the Rockets, who are trying to get up and down the floor as fast as possible. And for LaMarcus and Powell, those guys are gooey soft in the middle, like undone cookies out the oven. And if you're asking those dudes to to come out. They have to go out there and punish Ryan Anderson. They've got to punish Clint Capela. And they've proven, not only in the regular season, but in game one, that they're not going to be capable of doing it. And then they have to go out and switch on guys like Ariza and Ryan Anderson out there on the wing. And it's a really tough spot for them. So it's going to be interesting to see what Pop does because, you know, I saw one conversation trickle down the Twitter timeline last night. Does Kawhi have to play center? And do you try to flood the floor to match Houston with guys like Danny Green, get Manu out there more, you know, play Patty Mills even more just to try to match and keep up? Because you have to punish Houston with those long threes by getting back on the break and making them punish them on the fast break, and you have to convert when you slow down the offense. And they were able to do neither last night. So it'll be interesting to see what decisions Pop makes in game two.
Not just soft, but gooey soft, like cookies out the oven that aren't quite done.
Yes. Oh, those are the best cookies, by the way. Let's be clear. If the Spurs were cookies, they would be the greatest cookies of all time, but we're not talking about cookies right now. We're talking about the playoffs.
Oh, I absolutely love it. Eddie Meissonette joining us from Fox Sports and a host of others. Okay, your boys out there in the Bay Area, for those who don't know, you're in the San Francisco Bay Area. Are you right from the O or from the city?
Well, I rep for Oakland. I rep for the town, town biz all day. I'm from Oklahoma, but I live here now. And so, yeah, so but I'm here based in Oakland. That is correct.
Okay, that's cool. So, anyway, your boys don't want to go to Utah because it's boring. They rather would have faced the Clippers because LA's nightlife is so much better. And what was it? Was it Draymond? No, it wasn't Draymond. It was Andre Iguodala. Iguodala said, man, it's so boring there that you can't even get up for the games, you know, because you're lulled to sleep and then you forget, oh, yeah, I got a playoff game here. I got to get myself amped up. He said he could get more amped up in LA. I guess they're not too worried about any bulletin board material about insulting the city of the place that they're going to have to go play games 3 and 4. Your takeaway and your expectations of that series?
Hey, man, I've been to Salt Lake City twice, and on one hand, I can totally agree that it can be boring. But on the other hand, those places tend to be the type that remind you very quickly that a big event is happening. So if Andre Iguodala and Matt Barnes and the rest of the Warriors were worried about feeling like the presence of something big was going to happen in Salt Lake City, I'm pretty sure they will figure it out when Game 3 happens because it's going to be cracking. As far as the series is concerned, I think Gordon Hayward has an opportunity to prove to the world why people want to give him a max contract. Unfortunately, he's also going to be facing a quartet of wings that will try to dismantle him like a chop shop. And, I mean, they're going to throw Matt Barnes, Iguodala, Klay Thompson, Draymond Green, and probably Kevin Durant on him on different times whenever they have a chance to switch. And I'm terrified that he's going to be nullified in ways where we're going to forget he's out there. So, you know, if that's the case, then Utah, the benefit Utah has is they have these wing players that are long, lean, and can switch. And so it'll be interesting to see if Utah can try to maybe slow the game down a little bit, run more functional offenses, and try to find the players that are basically going to be matched up on Steph Curry and find the mark and attack. And if that means going to Rodney Hood more, is George Hill going to be able to attack Curry? These are going to be the situations that I think Utah will have to thrive and also make sure that Rudy Gobert is an active participant in the offense, him or Favors. And if they can do that, they might steal a game. Let's be real. They might steal one game.
Eddie Meissonette is our guest from Fox Sports and also from the Sports Fan Journal, where he is the editor-in-chief. Kevin Durant did not play a lot, obviously, in that first-round series. Of course, we know he was coming off of the injury right at the end of the regular season. What percentage is he right now going into this series? Do you know, or what can you put on it?
I would say he's probably 90% or so. It seems like they've been overly cautious with KD with good reason, considering the earlier injuries he's had and just the general nature of year three of the world takeover that's been the Warriors. They've quickly shifted into what the true priority is, which is winning championships. So there's really no need to compromise anything in terms to their talent. So I expect Kevin Durant to be in full form. My bigger concern with the Warriors is always the dynamic of sharing between KD and Curry. I think my good brother Ethan Strauss wrote a tremendous piece about Steph Curry and Kevin Durant and their dynamics both on and off the court and how that has had an impact on the team. And in particular, Steph being the Blazing Inferno, a.k.a. hitting Super Saiyan levels. Shout out to all the Dragon Ball Z fans in Toledo. Being able to just do a takeover of all things with the Warriors. And they have to balance that because I do think that when Steph is in full-fledged takeover mode, it gets the most out of the Warriors, where KD does have a tendency to bog down the offense because he still likes to dominate the ball. And so it'll be interesting to see how they work that dynamic in the conference semifinals.
Eddie, I too was disappointed that the Warriors weren't going to play the Clippers, but it had nothing to do with nightlife. It's only because I like the Clippers. I like Chris. I'm just a huge CP3 fan. I have been for a long, 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 long time, and I'm talking about going back to Wake. And I'm also tired of answering the question or trying to defend, you know, how come he can't get out of the first round or second round or whatever. And it's always something. It's an injury to him. And this case this year is an injury to Blake. But they still get to a game seven, and they can't get it done. And I don't know what to do. I thought they'd be better than what they are. I thought that quote-unquote big three of theirs was very, very good. And it just isn't working. And even with a championship coach like Doc there, is it time to break up the clip joint?
I would say that it might be time to tweak, but maybe not overhaul. And I look at two things in particular. Look, I think that you have to start asking the question if Doc Rivers is the best piece, the best leader of men for the team. And it's not that necessarily Doc Rivers is not a good head coach. But the scheme and the way that they try to handle the top teams in the NBA just hasn't worked. And so you look at that dynamic first because Doc's like, I can be the coach and I can be the GM. And we started looking at Doc a little crazy because one, man, you know, there's a certain level, I believe, of nepotism of, hey, I'm going to bring my son on to be the backup point guard. Never mind the fact that Austin Rivers has actually been kind of decent as a backup point guard, but I digress. Secondarily, they've never found a wing scorer to support Chris Paul in that issue because we asked Chris Paul to not only get the best shots for other people, but then get the best shots on the perimeter because nobody else outside of 20 minutes of shenanigans that is Jamal Crawford, which I love, it's just never been anything consistent. So that is an issue. And then when you couple that with the fact that at many times the Blake Griffin, DeAndre Jordan duo has felt like more of a duplicative output more than anything else, we've seen DeAndre Jordan thrive when Blake's not there. We've seen Blake thrive when DeAndre is not there. And the Clips seemingly don't miss a beat. So you have to start asking the question, do we really need both? Especially when someone like Blake Griffin, who has been injury prone, you have to wonder what the future is there. So I could see conversations happening with Blake. I could see more conversations happening with Doc Rivers. But in the wake of everything that happened with Donald Sterling and the way that Doc handled it, he might have a get-out-of-jail-free card for life there, and he might not never leave the Clippers.
You know, you bring up the wing score, Eddie. We're talking to Eddie Meissonette from Fox Sports and from the Sports Fan Journal. Why has a trade not been worked out for Carmelo Anthony to be that wing scorer? I just feel like you got to do something different in L.A. with the Clips. And obviously we know the Melo story. Phil Jackson doesn't want him around. And maybe that's why he wants to hang around. I don't know, just to kind of keep twisting the knife. But we just know how much Carmelo loves New York. But if Carmelo has any designs and any interest whatsoever in trying to pursue something beyond money and points, something relatively close to playoff success and maybe getting to a finals, and I know that it's still a tough road to hoe in the West because of the Warriors, but still, you'd think he'd want to go play with CP3 and try to make something happen. How come that deal has never, ever been close?
It's interesting. I don't know if, you know, it's hard to put that on Carmelo because I always wonder if the Clippers have ever said, we're putting Blake Griffin up for Carmelo. Is that something that the Knicks would actually want? B, is that something the Clippers would ever propose, right? It'd be nice if I could play the video game and turn off the salary cap and just add Carmelo to the Clippers and play him alongside all the other guys.
Salary cap's easy, though, right? I mean, aren't they both max contracts? They'd both be pretty doggone close. You could make that happen. And obviously it isn't working with Blake there. I mean, not that Blake can't play. He's very, very good, and I like Blake a lot, too. But I just feel like he needs a new place. And like I said, Carmelo, it's a mess. It's a mess, that relationship with him and Phil. I feel like if the Clippers ever called, or if Phil ever called the Clippers and said, we'll do this thing, it should get done. It would help everybody.
You know what's really interesting is I do think that Blake would actually be a great complement to somebody like Porzingis because Blake can play down low and Porzingis is willing to stretch out to 25 feet. What's more interesting to me is I actually think if Paul George wants to get to L.A., I actually feel like now might be the time for him to come to L.A., not to the Lakers, to the Clippers. And they might be able to work something out now that Larry Bird stepped down and there's a clear change of course. There's a potential change of course happening with the Pacers. And Paul George could come in and immediately be on a possible championship roster and give the Clippers the thing that they actually need. The Lakers still much more of a crapshoot because they still got a ton of young players and they do have money to spend. But the Clippers, he could step in there right now and be the guy that gets them, who knows, at least to the conference finals.
Eddie, last thing for you, because I brought up CP3, who's my guy.
Yes, sir.
I like the traditional old school point guard. That's not to say I'm not, enamored with guys like Russell and Curry and the squad. Kyrie, of course, my guy. But with CP3, I'm just such a huge fan. And yet I'm looking at the journal, your website, and I'm looking at the stat. Chris Paul has played in 76 career playoff games, the most all-time by a player to never make a conference finals, which is really, really crazy. And you wrote an hour ago, Chris Paul is this weird archetype of a player we want all players to aspire to play like, which I think goes against him at every turn because of his organization and supporting cast. Fans are critical of him because he's hoisted that high, but that's not his fault. He's brilliant, but I'm never sure how we should properly rate him. It's the ultimate conundrum. All right, I'm going to put it to you right now. You're not sure, but I'm going to ask you to properly rate him. Solve the conundrum, Eddie Meissonette. How do you rate Chris Paul currently and as an all-time point guard, given that playoff failure that we just outlined?
Yeah, I think he right now is a top five point guard in the NBA. And I think when we start looking at him all-time, he's going to probably rank as a top five, top six all-time point guard. I look at somebody, the funny thing is we compared Chris Paul to Isaiah Thomas coming in. He had the smile and he had the handle and he was able to defer. But people forget that Isaiah Thomas, when he first came in the league and they were running and gunning, he was putting up major numbers. He was putting major numbers with, I believe, Kelly Trepuka on those old Pistons teams. And they were getting buckets. And Chuck Daly came in there and said, do you want to make it about you, or do you want to win championships? And Chuck Daly instilled an offense and a scheme that got Isaiah Thomas to two championships. And his numbers declined a little bit, but he was still feared and respected on the court. And I think what's going to happen with Chris Paul is something similar. And I think that's the reason why I can't even put Chris Paul ahead of Isaiah at this point, even if the numbers may say otherwise, because Isaiah commanded a level of respect that Chris Paul just does not on the basketball court, not to his peers and not to his fans, but on the basketball court. So, Chris Paul still has, the good thing is the book's not closed on Chris Paul. I think he's a top five, top six all-time point guard. And I'm hopeful, and I think he could actually still rise in the next couple of years.
You know, when you talk about that comparison to Zeke, I mean, you know, you're talking to a ton of Piston fans right now here in Northwest Ohio and Southeast Michigan where you were broadcasting. The difference, I mean, I understand the comparison a little bit, but the difference was that Isaiah, even when Chuck Daly got him to defer a little bit and to make it more about, distribution and everything else, is that when a bucket was needed, it wasn't Joe Dumars and it wasn't Mark Aguirre and it wasn't anybody else. It was Zeke. I mean, it was still Isaiah. When you needed somebody to get a bucket and when you needed somebody to take over in moments even, it was still Isaiah Thomas. I don't know that Chris Paul is that guy. As much as I love him, for all the reasons I explained, he's not that kind of a dominant scorer. I mean, what's his high in his career, 22, 23 points a game? You know, but he's a 10-point, he's a 10-assist a game for his entire career guy. I don't know that he's a guy that can just take over and score, you know, 20 points and a half, if that's what it takes, or 25 points and a half to take over a game and change the complexion of a series or that sort of thing.
No, yeah, I agree. And look, let's be clear, man. Like, and this is what I was saying earlier about Chris Paul. He is in this circumstance where he has to get other people great shots. He's also the guy on his team who has to guard the better guards every time because of the lack of just defensive responsibility, or excuse me, the defensive stars on the Clippers. And then he's still being asked to get the best perimeter shots for his team. And look, man, at the end of the day, man, that man might be tired. Like, and he's battled injuries and dislocated fingers and, yeah, and everything else. And fatigue is a real thing. Look at Russell Westbrook in regards to fatigue, a man who we think never gets tired. So, that's why we start having these conversations about Melo and Paul George, not just because that the Clippers seem to need a wing scorer, but they need somebody on the perimeter that can just lighten the load a little bit. And you look at somebody like Kyrie Irving. If we're talking about Ohio, Kyrie Irving is able to thrive. Kyrie Irving is able to hit that game winner on Steph in Game 7, partially because he did not have to do all the heavy lifting in the series and in the game. And so those things matter when we're starting to talk about the dynamic plays and the dynamic reasons why players and teams and franchises win championships.
I think that's a fair enough point that you make. Last thing, Kyrie Irving, Steph Curry, one-on-one. I don't mean lead, point guard against point guard in a five-on-five. I mean they're on the playground, one-on-one. Those handles, that sick range they both have, who wins?
Okay, are we playing 1-on-1 to 11? Are we playing 1s and 2s? Because I grew up playing all 1s.
So I did too. I don't like 1s and 2s. I do not like 1s and 2s. You know, I really don't. If you're the way I heard somebody else talking about this the other day, not about these two guys, I just made that up, but just about how grown up. To me, if you're going to play 1-on-1 and you're going to use the three-point line, you play 2s and 3s. And the reason why is because when you make that long shot, you're only getting a third more points for it, as opposed to twice as many points like you do when you go 1s and 2s. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So to me, I think that's unfair to do it with 1s and 2s. So let's just say straight 1s.
You know what's interesting is both of them have, you know, everybody knows about their handle and everybody knows about their shooting prowess and their ability to finish near the rim. But 1-on-1 is about skullduggery and guerrilla warfare. And the thing I've noticed about Kyrie is that he actually has some levels of post-game and fadeaway. He has a fadeaway he can use in step-back game. And it's not that Steph doesn't have it. It's just that I've seen Kyrie do it more. So I would give a slight edge to Kyrie. But if they had to play 9 games, I think Kyrie wins 5 and Steph wins 4.
Okay.
Did I weasel my way out of that? Because
No, that was good. Well argued. and now I'm gonna throw one more at you just because this is fun. Is there anybody in 1-on-1 that you think would take Russell Westbrook? His athleticism changes everything. His athleticism just—I mean, you can put Kyrie since he just beat Steph in the semifinals. If it's the finals and it's Russell and Kyrie, is there anybody through all of the skullduggery that you talk about and the and the guerrilla warfare and the handles and the finish and the fade and the range? Could he hang with Russell, or is Russell going to out-athletic everybody in 1-on-1?
Well, you know what's interesting is that I think Russ is the type where he's going to win his share of 1-on-1 games, but he's the type of dude that after you play him once 1-on-1, you probably just don't want to play him no more. And you might beat him, but, you know, it's going to be so much going on that you're probably like, you know what, I'm going to go get a vanilla latte. I'm cool. I don't need to live this type of life because it's just going to be a lot of elbows and it's going to be a lot of snarls and it's just, you know, and who knows what he's going to be wearing. Like, you know, it's just going to be an entire affair. So, you know, I think, you know, just getting the cross match of what Westbrook is as a player is one thing, but I just imagine, you know, after you play him once or twice, you're like, you know what, I'm cool. I'm going to go play Monopoly or something.
You know who could absorb the elbows and the flash or whatever he's wearing and everything you just said that might drive somebody to the latte? Who would absorb it and give back just as much of it as he takes would be John Wall.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
I think Wall could hang with him in a one-on-one, and they would get up in each other's behinds, boy.
Yeah, no, Wall is I'm so glad that Wall is getting the spotlight. in a way that is deserved. And he's going to be – it's so fun to watch him go up against Boston. And, yes, Wall versus Westbrook. I would pay money. I would pay pay-per-view money to watch that in a one-on-one contest. We should probably do a bracket and have the ultimate one-on-one.
Well, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put it together. Just those four. I'm going to have Kyrie and Steph in one semifinal, Wall and Russell in the other in the winner's play, and then we'll see. Then we'll really know. That would be something crazy. Eddie Meissonette, Fox Sports and the Sports Fan Journal, Slam Magazine, SB Nation, all over the place. Longest business card anybody's ever seen. Eddie, thanks so much for talking hoops with us, man. We appreciate it.
Anytime and every time. Thank you, guys.
You got it. Have a great one. All right. Congratulations to Sean Waldron and to Kelly Conley, both from Toledo. They are going to go see the Mudhens on Friday. We gave those tickets away last segment. Going to get a quick timeout here now and get a kind of bottom of the hour, but more like quarter of the hour SportsCenter update after I remind you about your chance to win the Ugly Driveway. You don't want to win an Ugly Driveway. You have a chance to win the Ugly Driveway contest to get a brand new driveway to replace your ugly driveway. ESPN 106.5 The Ticket and Buck Brothers giving you a chance to enter the Ugliest Driveway contest. You've got to submit your picture of your ugly A driveway by the 14th. Contest ends May 14th at midnight. Just go to 106.5theticket.com, take a picture of your busted old driveway, and send it in. If you are the winner, you'll get a brand new one from Buck Brothers and ESPN's 106.5 The Ticket back after this.
ESPN 106.5 ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
I want to know, Frank Gargano, when somebody is going to put up that money, whether it's Nike or Under Armour or a combination thereof or Microsoft.
I think I know where you're going, but keep going.
I want somebody to sponsor the ultimate one-on-one challenge. That's where I'm going.
Ooh.
Is that where you thought I was going?
No, I thought you were making fun of the big baller brand not being able to get a sponsor. But
No, I like this. I want to make what I just kind of came up with off the top of my head, you know, because we're all looking forward to and expecting, I think, a Warriors-Cavaliers final again for the third straight year. And part of that is, you know, you do the pairings and, you know, who do the Warriors have? Are they going to throw LeBron? Can Draymond Green stop LeBron? Can Kyrie guard Steph? Can Steph guard Kyrie? And on down the line. And it just got, that's why I kind of said to him, forget about the actual finals in the game. If it was just one-on-one, who would win between the two best sets of handles in the NBA? Kyrie and Steph. I want that to happen. There was a time back in the day when the NBA would have, and I think it was over All-Star Weekend, but it might not be, and maybe it was in the off-season. Mm-hmm. They had horse competitions. Do you remember this? You're probably too young.
When would you say this was?
Early 80s, maybe? Late 70s, yeah. Early 80s?
No.
You'd have to look back. I know you're not old enough to remember it. You know, live, but I mean, if you'd heard of it.
I've heard about it. I haven't really researched it.
They would do horse competitions between current NBA players, and they would just play. It would be like a Saturday. Yeah, it wasn't All-Star Weekend. I'm right. It was in the offseason. It would just be like a Saturday afternoon as part of Wide World of Sports or something. You know, they would just, because it's back before pre-ESPN and all the other 24-hour sports networks. And it was just so cool, you know, to have NBA players, you know, playing horse against one another. And it was just neat. And, of course, they didn't play one-on-one because, you know, we're probably worried about injuries or whatever the case might be. But I would love to see something like that in the off-season. And I would love to create – now, you'd have to pay them like crazy.
Yep.
And provide them with some sort of insurance protection. You know, if you get injured playing in this thing, then we'll pay you $25 million or something like that, so, you know, if it costs you your career. Or whatever. You'd need to do something stupid, and it would take a ton of sponsors to pay them what they would want. Number one, to do it with the risk of injury. But number two, something far, far worse. What's far worse to one of these modern NBA superstars than being injured? What would the worst thing be?
Oh, man.
Don't know?
Worse than being injured?
Yeah.
Losing your shoe deal?
Losing. No, just losing, period. That's it, losing. The injury to their ego would be far greater than the injury to their body if they lost. Because you saw what I just said. Did you see the hats that Russell Westbrook is marketing now? Mr. Yeah. Triple-Double.
Oh,
is what
my
it's...
God. Congrats, buddy.
These guys live for their own egos. They live to feed their own egos. And if you actually agreed to go into a one-on-one tournament with the winners playing each other like I was just describing, somebody's going to lose. And they would have to admit, oh, damn, I'm not as good as blank. And that would hurt their brand and their ego. That's why it would never come off.
Yeah, no way.
You would have to pay them such an astronomical amount of money just not to worry about their injured bodies, but to injure their psyche, their pride. That's what would happen. Because like I said, if John Wall and Russell Westbrook were to go head-to-head and Wall were to beat Westbrook, Westbrook would lose his mind.
He would
go crazy because of that ego.
Well, we'd get a laundry list of excuses of what went down. Like, it would be such a prima donna show, Bob. It'd be so entertaining.
And here's the thing, too. You would have to play at the playground rules.
Oh,
meaning you call your own fouls. Because if you had an official calling the foul, that would be the excuse. But you got to call your own fouls. And some of these guys, you know, are hardcore playground veterans. You know, they're going to play through most fouls, but with the game on the line, if it's 10-9 and Wall is going to, and Russell's going to the rack or something, and he even gets whispered on by Wall, he's going to call his own foul, and then there's going to be all kinds of arguments. But how fun would this be from an entertainment standpoint?
Oh, I'd love it. I think it'd be so much fun.
And you know, you would create different divisions too. The 6-4 and under division.
Different classes.
Again, and then you'd have the 6-5 to 6-8 division, and then the 6-9 and up above division. And that way you could have LeBron James going one on one with Melo. Then you could have, you know, LeBron going one on one with Kevin. No, actually Kevin Durant would be in the big guy division. Cause he's like a 7'4" or 6'11" anyway.
Yeah.
He would be going against, you know, the Brooke Lopez's and DeAndre Jordan's and Boogie Cousins, you know, the big 7-foot variety.
This could get really ugly, Bob.
But it could be really fun. Oh, my God. Can you imagine? I'm going to put the brackets together. Swear to God. I don't know. I'm probably too lazy to do it by tomorrow's show. But by the end of the week, I'm
going to
put a bracket together, and we're going to play what will never happen in reality. We're going to play a virtual game of one-on-one tournament, and we'll kind of predict, maybe me, you, and Kush, we'll let the callers be a part of it, and we'll predict who would win each matchup, and then kind of advance it, just like a Sweet 16 kind of a thing, with each of the three divisions, height divisions, and we'll find our champions. I think it'd be a hell of a lot of fun. All right, thanks to Eddie Meissenet for joining us. Thanks also to Dennis Maniloff, and thanks to you for joining us. And thanks to Frank and to Kush as well. Tomorrow, back again for the next extravaganza. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.